Sometimes when you read a book, when you get to the end of it, there will be a section that says appendix. And as you well know, what that means is that there was something that the writer really wanted to tell his readers, but it just didn't quite fit in the storyline that he was going through. And so when he comes to the end of it, he's going to tell what he wanted to tell earlier. In some ways, this morning, the lesson is an appendix to the four that we've previously talked about over the past month. That as we have looked at Joseph and as we've seen him go from a household where his brothers hated him to a household where a wicked woman lied about him to a prison where people forgot about him, Joseph really never allowed himself to become a victim during that time, though certainly by the definition of victim, we could say that he was. We look at all of his words, we look at all of his actions, we look at all of his deeds, and nothing is pointing in that direction. In fact, it's very much just the opposite. And as I was going through these lessons, and because of some other studies I had been asked to do kind of in the midst of all of that, this idea kept coming to mind that there is a lesson in the 21st century about victimization that we need to learn from Joseph. And so this morning, that's what I'd like for us to talk about, to discuss how that as we read these things, the vast amount of things God has told us about his servant Joseph, never do we find him portraying himself in that way. So let's begin with, first of all, the idea of being a victim. I don't want in any way for anybody to think that I don't believe victims exist, because they very much do. And there are people of every age who are victims. How do we know that? Well, the Bible tells us that. In fact, if you think about the book of Psalms, throughout Psalms we find that. But look in particular at verse 10, where the psalmist says, "But you do see, for you note mischief and vexation that you may take into your own hands. To you, the helpless." In fact, there are some translations there that put victim there. You, the victim. You, the helpless, commits himself. You have been the helper of the fatherless. As long as man exists, there are going to be people who mistreat other people. There are going to be those who put others down. That's going to be pretty much a state of being. But that's not what we're talking about this morning. What we're talking about this morning is not whether they're victims. It's the idea of allowing ourselves to adopt what in modern times has been referred to as the victim mentality. So as we consider that, if we think about a definition of that, the victim mentality would be one who believes that he or she is always a victim. The idea that bad things will always happen to me. And what's interesting in this is when you put in Google or whatever search engine you use, victim mentality, you're not going to find a great number of biblical sites coming up. In fact, it's mainly going to be from the field of psychology that we're finding this. And one thing I was amazed at is how many psychologists are warning against this idea, completely separate from anything biblical or spiritual. What they're saying is the danger that it poses on just a secular basis. But they go on to say this, that if one adopts that victim mentality of believing one is always a victim and it's always going to happen, then the attitude that person adopts, the mindset that is taken on, is that someone or something is keeping my life from getting better. That because of these circumstances, because there's somebody or something out there, that's keeping me from having the kind of life that I desire to have. Why do you and I need to talk about this? The concept of having a victim mentality is not only on the rise in our culture, but also very much encouraged. We are living in a time in which people are told that because of your economic background, or because of your race, or because of your gender, or because of your lifestyle decisions. There are going to be people who have been mistreated because of what you've gone through, and therefore you are deserving of something. You are deserving of perhaps compensation, or you're deserving of a place highlighted in society because you have never had that before. And thus the idea is, because somebody or something has been holding you back in the past, you need to adopt this mentality. Now, we're not here to discuss psychology this morning. So our question is this really how God wants us to view life? Does He want us to view life that we are constantly under somebody else's control besides His, that somebody or something is keeping our lives from getting better? I can't help but believe that one of the benefits that we are to find within the book of Genesis in this elaborate account of Joseph is the answer to this question. That indeed God does not want us viewing our lives in this way, that somehow life is beyond our control, but instead to look to Him. So let's look at that in Joseph. We did not talk much in our lessons previously about the early days of Joseph's rise in Egypt and the things that happened to him, but he was given a wife. Pharaoh made sure that he was married, and he has two children that will come to play a pretty prominent role in Israel's history. One thing, though, that we need to not read over is what the names of these children meant. Today, when we name our children, that's not really as much of a big deal as it used to be, especially in Bible times. In fact, you may actually have no idea what your name originally meant. But that was not the case for Joseph. The names that he gave to his two sons played a very important role. His oldest son, Manasseh, his name actually meant forgetting. And Joseph goes on to describe and explain why he names his son this, because he says, God has made me forget all my hardship and all my father's house. What do we know off the bat? We know this doesn't mean that he suddenly forgot all of his past and he had no recollection of it. He knew who his brothers were. He knew who Benjamin was. He knew who his father was. That's not what it's talking about. But through God, Joseph was able to forget revenge and hatred and retaliation. And all of the emotions that we might feel naturally fit in someone who had been victimized as Joseph had been by his family. Yet he says, all of that is forgotten to me. That's something in the past that I am not going to bring back to some kind of remembrance that will cause me to take action. But then he has another son. And the second son that he has, Ephraim, has a name that means fruitful. And again, Joseph explains why he names him this. He says, God has made me fruitful in the land of my affliction. So you look at those two sons, and the first son, he's saying, I have forgotten all of those feelings that I might have had in a bad way toward the past. And what I'm doing is remembering what God has done for me now. And in the naming of his sons, Joseph shows us how to overcome a victim mentality. He says you got to learn to forget and remember. You got to learn to forget those things that could cause you to have the kind of attitude that life is out of control, that somebody, something is causing me trouble, and remember that God is the one who's going to provide. What I find so interesting in both of these verses is that full credit's given to God. God has made me forget. God has made me fruitful. In other words, Joseph is saying, if I had been left to myself, I might have died a bitter man for all that had happened, not realizing all of the great things that are around me. But Joseph says God is making sure that's not the case. So let's delve into that for a few minutes. How did Joseph defeat that victim mentality? How was it that Joseph came to a point that he could put all of these things behind, forget all of these things, and count his blessings? Well, first of all, one thing we find is that he allowed no place for self-pity. Let's define terms again. When we look at this term, it's one that perhaps we use quite often, but maybe not really understanding fully what it means. This definition, I believe, sums it up. a self-indulgent dwelling on one's sorrows. A self-indulgent dwelling on one's sorrows. In other words, it actually goes beyond just remembering those things, but it's also allowing you permission to think in a particular way that you ought not to think. There was a writer by the name of John Gardner, and I like this quote. As he looked at these things, he said, "Self-pity is easily the most destructive of the non-pharmaceutical narcotics. It is addictive, gives momentary pleasure, and separates the victim from reality." That's the definition of self-pity. That what I am doing is I'm giving myself permission to indulge in things that are not going to be helpful for me because it's releasing me from the reality I just don't quite like. But here's the scary thing. When we consider this idea of self-pity, it is really, really easy for good people to fall to the temptation. Let's not think that because we are the people of God, we are never going to have any problems with self-pity. I imagine that if I asked for some true life testimonials today, every adult in the room could say, "Yes, I've fallen into that category." Because we know great men of the past have. You remember one of the greatest? The man Elijah is on the run from Jezebel. And he's speaking to God and he says, "I have been very jealous for the Lord, the God of hosts. For the people of Israel have forsaken your covenant, thrown down your altars, killed your prophets with the sword. And I, even I only, am left and they seek my life to take it away." I sure don't want to put down Elijah. He's one of the greatest men who ever lived. One of my favorite Old Testament people. But nonetheless, this is self-pity. It fits the definition, doesn't it? It's an indulgence to think about what's going on, to make a break from reality. Everybody is trying to get me, Elijah says. I am the only one who is left. And so many times, that's what self-pity does, is it creates a world where nobody understands us, nobody can relate, nobody can help. And we allow that to take control of our lives. I always have to be very careful when preparing a sermon because I'm kind of like a squirrel mindset many times and just kind of get distracted as I'm studying. But one thing I came across was actually a psychological study that had been done on people who demonstrated excess self-pity. And you look at the title of this, "Self-Pity: Exploring the Links to Personality, Control, Beliefs, and Anger." And what Dr. Joachim Stieber did was he came up through his studies of what this produces. I'm not going to spend much time on this, but I just want to show you some of his conclusions. He said after studying people with high levels of self-pity, he found that these people viewed self as controlled by chance or powerful others. In other words, what? Life is not under my control. And he went on to say that one is viewed as defenseless because life is out of control and others or chance are over me. There's nothing I can do about it. And he said what this does is it produces this high level of emotional loneliness. It's kind of like what we saw in Elijah. Where Elijah feels like life is just out of control and everything's working against him. And here he is sitting all alone and he says, "I'd just rather die than be in this situation." And he went on to say it produces a high level of anger rumination. We're going to talk more about that in just a minute. But the idea is it gives you the opportunity to relive the situation over and over and over. Why do I put all of this up here? Let's look at Joseph. One verse shows us Joseph was not a man of self-pity. As he's talking to Potiphar's wife, he says, "He is not greater in this house than I am. Nor has he kept back anything from me except you, because you are his wife. How then can I do this great wickedness and sin against God?" Could Joseph have felt like powerful others were in control of him? when the lady of the house is trying to do these kinds of things, yes. Could he have viewed himself as defenseless? I'm just a servant within this house. Could he have felt all alone? My brother sold me out. My father didn't come looking for me. Could he have become angry? But what did he do? He said, I am in control of this situation. And if it cost me my job or if it cost me my life, I will not allow this sin against my master, but more importantly, I will not sin against God. That's being in control. That's the idea of saying, I am not going to allow self-pity to rule every decision that I make. So then, when Joseph made the decision that he would not allow self-pity to rule his life, the only way he could do that was to say, I am going to forget what's gone on in the past. As I mentioned earlier, that is not voiding one's mind of any recollection of it. It's the idea that he was not going to hang on to the situation and replay it over and over and over again. Are you as guilty in doing this as I am? A bad situation happens in your life. Typically, someone has treated you pretty bad. And so for the next day, week, month, year, decade, however long, we're constantly reliving it. We're constantly thinking about how we were hurt. We're constantly thinking about how we were mistreated. We're constantly thinking about how someone did not do us the right way. When that happens, what we are doing is we are allowing others to be blamed for our bad outcome. If he hadn't treated me this way, if she hadn't done this, if they had allowed. And what we do is we say this to ourselves over and over to give ourselves permission to ruminate, to dwell, to chew on these things. It also allows the bitterness and the hatred in our hearts to grow. Because every time we think about that, and every time we go over how we were abused and misused, it just allows that bitterness to become even more powerful. And it allows others to be put in a situation where we think they've got something I ought to have. Others haven't had to go through this. Others haven't had to deal with it. So many times anymore, I don't know if it's always been, but certainly in our culture, it's the idea of blaming one's family, one's parents typically, for what's going on. As I thought about this, I came across a cartoon I found very telling that kind of puts all of this in perspective. If you look at this, it's the Adult Children of Normal Parents annual convention. How many of us come from normal households? Well, I doubt there's too many that could testify to that. Because what we're doing is we're being raised by people who are learning how to raise children. And those mistakes are going to be made, but so many times what we say is, well, if my parents had just, if my family had just, if I could have got the same treatment as my brothers and sisters, just. And we build up these worlds within our minds, and really what we're doing is we're setting ourselves up in such self-pity that we'll never overcome it. I want you to think about how Paul overcame this. I'm perhaps taking this verse a bit out of context, but yet not in relation to what Paul would have said in other places. When we look at Philippians chapter 3 and verse 13, Paul says, brothers, I do not consider that I have made it my own, but one thing I do, forgetting what lies behind and straining forward to what lies ahead. That should be our goal. When there are things in my past, as we all have, that did not go the way we wanted, we get over it. We get over it. And we press ahead. The apostle is basically saying even good things we've done in the past, we get over it. We don't rest on those things. But the same principle would apply to those things that are behind. So what about Joseph? Joseph came to terms with his past. Do you think you would have had a hard time forgetting the looks of your brothers as you cried out to them from the pit, begging them to save you, only to see them go and make a deal to sell you as a slave? To have no idea that your father thought you were dead and thinking perhaps that he had forgotten you, just as your brothers had. Joseph overcame that. And not only overcame, but he moved forward. And in this, he demonstrates a great quality of God. Because you see, you and I hurt God every time we sin. And it may be difficult for us to consider that we have the power within us to hurt God, but that's surely what he says. That when we sin against him, his creation rebelling against him, that's an affront. But yet, what does God say when those sins are forgiven? He says they are forgotten. Does that mean God no longer has the ability to recollect those sins? No. What it means, though, is those sins are done. He's not going to go back and keep bringing them up and reliving the situation and thinking what he ought to have done and should have done. And that's exactly why Joseph is a godly man, because he could say, yes, these people did things wrong against me, but that's not going to destroy me. That's not going to stop me from being what I need to be. And what an amazing godly characteristic it is when we can truly say, okay, I'm forgetting about it. In other words, none of my decisions are going to be prefaced by how you treated me in the past. That's God. And that's how we need to be. And the good thing about this is that Joseph didn't waste his life. If I sit around thinking about how bad life is for me, I'm wasting the gift that God has given. And so, we come to the point then. I've got to entrust God with my future. But how do I do that? How is it that I can actually trust this God who I can't see, I can't touch? How do I trust Him and know He's there? How do I deal with life when things are happening and I don't know what my future is going to hold? I imagine to a room full of engineers, when I talk about Occam's razor, you know exactly what I'm talking about. Occam's razor says the simplest explanation is usually the correct one. It's the idea of if we can just think simply, we usually keep ourselves out of trouble and find the answer. So let's cut to the chase. How is it we trust God with the future? Jesus says, don't be anxious about tomorrow. Tomorrow is going to take care of itself. Sufficient is the day for its trouble. You see, we all have a really bad habit of saying, what am I going to do? You know, what if I live to be 95 and I lose my job and I don't have any means of support and I get sick and I can't get insurance and my family doesn't take care of me and my house burns down and the neighbor's dog bites me and, you know, we just go on down the line. Take today. Today's all you got. Live it, Jesus says, for God. And then do the same thing tomorrow if He gives that to you. And if you get a day after that, do the same thing. Don't borrow all of this trouble. Trust that God's got it under control. And no matter what the situation looks like today, be like Joseph. Stand up for what's right. Don't cave when it might appear from all circumstances God has forgotten you. Don't exercise vengeance and retaliation when you got the chance. Live for the day. Well, as we bring these thoughts to their conclusion, the real question is, how do I defeat the victim mentality? It's one thing for Joseph to do it. But how do I do it? How is it that I can do that? Well, the first thing is, don't go to war against reality. Things can change. We can improve our lives for the better. But where we are today is where we are today. And if I war against reality, I'm never going to get over that feeling. You see, life is not fair or unfair. Life is life. What happens to us is going to happen to us. And thus, when I consider that, I've got to make sure that unlike the folks in that study who were really given to high levels of self-pity, that I don't fall into the habit of blaming somebody else for the unhappiness I'm experiencing, because we know that's going to cause me to lose touch with reality. I'll not accept the day for what it is. I'll accept the day for what it ought to be if those folks... You see, that's how I defeat that mentality. And I do not allow myself to be in this perpetual state of unhappiness. I don't want to sound like a motivational speaker this morning, but I don't know any other way to say it. We are in charge of whether or not we're happy. That's our department. And whatever the situation is, it may not be really enjoyable and it may be very difficult, but whether I'm joying in life, happy in life, that is totally up to me. I can't turn that over to someone else, because blaming others will get you nowhere. Is that not the case with King Saul? As Saul offered a sacrifice when he shouldn't have, Samuel says, the kingdom is taken away from you. And Saul said, well, if you had come, if God had been appeased, if the Philistines hadn't been attacking, if my men hadn't been running away, all of those are true. But God said, you're the one who's in charge of this. You're the one who makes the decisions. And that's what he says to us as well. Let me also suggest to us that we leave vengeance to God. You see, there's always going to be victimizers, but God's going to handle that. In fact, he's told us all about it. He says this, beloved, never avenge yourselves, but leave it to the wrath of God. For it is written, vengeance is mine. I will repay, says the Lord. God says, when somebody mistreats you, I'm not ignoring that. Because I don't strike them down with a bolt of lightning at the time doesn't mean I'm forgetting about it. He says that my justice will be shown and wrath will be shown to those who deserve that wrath. But that's not your job. Your job, if your enemy's hungry, feed him. If he's thirsty, give him something to drink. Your job is to be the best person that you can be, because you are not God. But what a wonderful thing when God takes that burden off of us. Because that means then that I have the time to do good, and like Joseph, to forget my painful past, that instead of letting my mind dwell on these things and chew on these things over and over, just getting more and more angry and more bitter, I can leave all of that, say, God's got it under control. I'm going to take care of my enemy. I'm going to do good. And that means that I trust that God can create a good conclusion. Bad things happen in life. We don't want to deceive ourselves with that. And we may die never seeing wrongs righted. But that doesn't mean we should be destroyed. In fact, you'll recall in Philippians chapter 4, the apostle said, the peace of God, which surpasses all understanding, will guard your hearts and your minds in Christ Jesus. Paul says that God says, I'm going to give you a peace that there's no way you can explain it. But it's going to be like a soldier standing guard at your heart. And it's going to be like a soldier standing guard at your mind, not allowing the bitterness and the self-pity to come in. But that's only half the story. We've got to preface this. Paul says, do not be anxious about anything, but in everything, by prayer and supplication, with thanksgiving, let your requests be known to God. And the peace of God, which surpasses all understanding, will guard your hearts and your minds in Christ Jesus. You see, it means I pray. And I cry out to God, and I thank God. You think Joseph did any of that? As he was being carried off to slavery in Egypt, you think he had any prayers in Potiphar's house in those prison years? You think he ever prayed? Of course he did. And the apostle says, if you want that peace, you remember, you've got some responsibility too. And that's making sure that you are crying out to God and remembering all of the good things He's done and remembering the things that He can still do. And that requires that we have the new mindset, the mindset of Christ, as Paul talked about to the Corinthians, the renewal of our mind, as he talked about to the Romans, that no matter how things may look in the present, if I'm allowing God to control things in my life, my future is secure, and thus, while not everything may be just great happiness here, I can have the joy that comes with a peace that says, no matter what's going on, God has it under control. And you see, when I reach that level of maturity in thought, all of this baggage of bitterness and hatred and doubt and self-pity, you see, all of that can be done away with. And I can then trust that God is going to take me where I need to go.